blind beasts whose brains were concentrated entirely in a few top commanders. Napoleon's army was one that moved fast, fed itself on the ruins of its prey, and derived its intelligence and sensory input from hundreds of thousands of individual mobile units. And everywhere Napoleon's ambitions drove him, throughout Europe, deep into Russia, even south into Egypt. The old regime armies gave way before this new and more highly evolved form of predator beast. The French and American revolutions are, of course, best known for their effects in realms unrelated to the business of killing. They shattered the centuries-old structures of aristocratic and dynastic domination, thereby opening up an entirely new sense of the possible, not only to the middle class, and in the American case, often wealthy, men who led them, but to the poor, and, eventually, to that perennial lower class, women. The French Revolution, in particular, revised the calculus of human hope and despair, convincing some that real change for the better is within reach, and others that no real change is ever possible, only a bloody reshuffling of the people on top. But from a military point of view, the effect of the revolutions was brutally simple. They made possible, for the first time, the full exploitation of the killing power of the gun. The potential had always been there, but it could not be utilized in old regime societies with their rigidly old regime armies, in which the use of the gun had been reduced to a ritual of drill. The promise and horrific menace of the gun could be fulfilled only by a gun bearer who was capable of seeing and moving and taking aim on his own. And this was the new revolutionary citizen soldier. Writing later in the 19th century, Karl Marx expected socialist revolution to bring human social relations into line with the technological promise of the newly industrialized means of production. Obviously, human relationships could not remain stuck in, say, the feudal era, at a time when production was taking place in steam-powered factories. What Marx did not notice is that the bourgeois revolutions, French and American, had already succeeded in bringing the social relations of war into line with the means of destruction. Inevitably, such a drastic change in the practice of war had to affect the passions men brought to war. In the new era, notions of glory and sacrifice could no longer be confined to a narrow hereditary class of warriors, because the new method of fighting made every man a warrior in the old-fashioned sense. Like the high-born knight or samurai, the citizen soldier was expected to display initiative, make lightning judgments, and perform acts of heroism. At the very least, he in turn could expect to share in the glory of war. The renown and tangible marks of esteem, formerly reserved for valorous members of the warrior elite. The first step in the crafting of a new mass religion of war was, accordingly, what we might call the democratization of glory. In the American and French Revolutionary armies, honors and distinctions such as medals and stripes were awarded, for the first time, to ordinary soldiers. The effect of this was to undermine the ancient association between nobility and hereditary wealth. In the medieval hierarchy of values, qualities such as courage and altruism were almost inseparable from membership in the economic elite, so that words like noble and base referred to both character and social standing. Noblemen, in the economic sense, were expected to be courageous and self-sacrificing in war. But no one expected to find moral qualities in the lower classes who made up the soldiery. Neither courage, nor loyalty, nor group spirit, nor sacrifice, nor self-reliance. The presumed character defects of the average foot soldier had long been recognized as a military handicap. In the very first European Revolution, that of the English in 1660, Oliver Cromwell had written to his cousin and fellow revolutionary, John Hampton, "Your troops are mostly old, worn-out serving men, wine-bibbers and similar riffraff. On the other hand, the enemy's troops are sons of gentlemen and young men of position. Do you believe that the courage of such miserable and common fellows will ever be equal to that of men who have honor, courage, and resolution in their hearts? You must seek to raise men of a single spirit, and, do not begrudge me what I am saying, of a spirit that is equal to that of a gentleman." If the mass armies of the early modern period had proletarianized the foot soldier, reducing him from the status of peasant to that of a cog in a machine, the revolutionary armies of the late 18th and 19th centuries now nobilized him. He too had a shot at glory. He too had honor to defend. And he too possessed what had once been the trappings of the nobly born. A flag, for example, which now symbolized a vast population rather than a single dynasty. According to Vaught, the tricolor flag of France gratified emotions previously enjoyed only by the nobility. In short, the whole nation had become the nobility. The trade-off for this elevation in status was that the average male now risked a much higher chance of dying in battle than had his peasant ancestors in the era of knightly combat. Napoleon was particularly wanton in his squandering of men as cannon fodder, expecting them not just to stand and shoot, but to charge fearlessly at the enemy's artillery positions. He fielded the largest armies Europe had ever seen, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, and lost a total of 1.3 million to 1.5 million of his own men in the course of his conquests. Enough to leave a lasting dent in the population of the nation, whose interests he supposedly fought to advance. In exchange for being nobilized by the new revolutionary ethos, the soldier was expected to more willingly give his life. And in exchange for giving his life, he would be given a share of glory. But the democratized glory accessible to the average soldier was a strangely depersonalized version of the glory sought by members of the traditional warrior elite. The knight, or samurai, wanted glory for himself as an individual, or at most, for his noble lineage. It was his own name that he announced in the battlefield challenge to the enemy, his own name that he hoped would be remembered forever in epics and chansons. But the kind of glory held out to men in the armies of George Washington, Napoleon Bonaparte, and all military leaders since their time need have no name attached to it at all. Democratized glory can be thoroughly anonymous glory, of the kind celebrated in the peculiar institution of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. As Benedict Anderson writes, "No more arresting emblems of the modern culture of nationalism exist than cenotaphs and tombs of unknown soldiers. The public ceremonial reverence accorded these monuments precisely because no one knows who lies inside them has no true precedence in earlier times." This new kind of glory, attached not to the individual, but to a new kind of entity, the hypothetical collectivity which the French revolutionaries heralded as la nation. If the revolutionary armies encouraged individual initiative, they were still mass armies, like those of the old regime. Revolution may have empowered the individual, but the revolutionary armies were still a far cry from being collections of knights, each charging off on his own pursuit of personal glory. Napoleon understood the difference and reserved the notion of glory for the old knightly tradition. Modern soldiers were not to confuse love of fatherland with love of glory. To one of Napoleon's admirers, the Prussian philosopher Hegel, true valor was not knightly valor, but rather, the true valor of civilized nations is their readiness for sacrifice in the service of the state, so that the individual merely counts as one among many. Not personal courage, but integration into the universal, is the important factor here. And the universal, meaning the nation. And for Hegel, even more mystical entities beyond that was in the first instance the modern mass army. 12. An imagined bestiary. Behold, the people shall rise up as a great lion, and lift up himself as a young lion. He shall not lie down until he eat of the prey, and drink the blood of the slain. Numbers, chapter 23, verse 24. The nation is one of the most mysterious categories of modern thought. It is, most citizens of nations would agree, something that people are willing to die for. But anyone seeking a more precise and scientific definition will be plunged into a swamp of turgid scholarship, which gets even more deeply frustrating if the quest is expanded to include the passions inspired by nations, or nationalism. There are not many things people are willing to die for that they cannot point to, or touch, or even adequately put into words. One historical reason for the mystery of nations and nationalism is that the great social theorists of the 19th century were transfixed by something far removed from the thought of glorious and voluntary death. After the hideous bloodletting of the Napoleonic Wars, Europe lapsed into a period of peace and economic development. It was the capitalist market economy, burgeoning throughout much of Europe since the early 1800s, that fascinated Karl Marx and Adam Smith. As John Keegan writes, Marx put all his emphasis on the market economy, largely because, at the time when he wrote, finance and investment overshadowed all other forces in society, and the military class, exhausted by the Napoleonic Wars and dispirited by the defeat of its interests in Russia in 1825 and in France in 1830, was at an unnaturally low ebb of self-confidence. The rise of the market favored a new materialist view of humanity as rational, calculating individuals seeking to advance their individual interests. In fact, the phrase "the wealth of nations" in the title of Adam Smith's 1776 volume is a misnomer. Only individuals, or corporations, were the possessors of the wealth that built factories and harnessed the power of steam. Nations were of little interest to Smith or to Marx, and in the harsh capitalist world their theories described, there was no possible motive for giving anything, perhaps especially one's life. In the Marxist paradigm that has played such a large role in Western social thought, nationalism could only be a form of false consciousness, a seemingly irrational distraction from the class struggle through which working people, banding together, would advance their true interests. For a long time, the puzzle of nations and nationalism could be sidestepped by assuming that nations are natural groupings, analogous to biological families. If there were indeed significant genetic commonalities among, say, French people or Germans, then it could be argued that a soldier giving his life for one of these nations is, in some small measure, acting in his own genetic self-interest. But even the most venerable nations turn out to be mongrels. France has its Bretons, with their distinct language and traditions. Britain, its Scots and Welsh. Spain uneasily embraces the Basques and Catalonians. Furthermore, most of the world's nations are hardly venerable, but are newcomers like Uganda, or, for that matter, Italy. Instead of being rooted in fixed bloodlines, nations are fairly arbitrary agglomerations, forever being shaped and reshaped, like Russia or Yugoslavia, by the vicissitudes of politics and war. In Benedict Anderson's memorable phrase, nations are not natural, but imagined communities, whose imagining has taken a great deal of conscious effort. In the European cases, intellectuals had to resurrect the folklore and epics which could be used to give people a sense of a common past. The printing press, along with the new market in what we now call information, had to publicize these findings to increasingly literate publics. State-sponsored schools had to impose a common vernacular language on what was often a hodgepodge of dialects and then educate people to literacy in it. Equally strenuous efforts were required in the Third World, where national boundaries had often been laid down arbitrarily for the convenience of the European colonialists. The work of Anderson and of historian Eric Hobsbawm has much to tell us about the creation of nations as a purely cognitive undertaking. How do people come to believe there is such a thing as Serbia or France? What these scholars fail to explain, however, are the passions that attach themselves to the idea of the nation, the emotions of nationalism. In Imagined Communities, Anderson seems to promise at the beginning to explain the religious power of the nation over its citizens. But we are quickly immersed in the relatively bloodless business of imagining, the construction of common languages and traditions, and so forth. The reason for this oversight, it seems to me, is that these writers, like most who owe something to the Marxist tradition, pay almost no attention to war as a factor shaping human societies. But what is France, if not as defined against England or Germany? What is Serbia, if not as defined against Germany or Croatia? From the very beginning, as the military historian Michael Howard has written, the principle of nationalism was almost indissolubly linked, both in theory and practice, with the idea of war. The immediate forerunner of nationalism, as we have seen, lies in the experience of community engendered in the mass armies of pre-revolutionary and pre-nationalist Europe. In these armies, the individual soldier knows that he is threatened by distant forces, foreigners who wish him dead. He knows, too, that he is, as an individual, helpless in the face of this threat. But he is not just an individual. He is a unit, as the constant drilling, if nothing else, convinces him, of something far larger and more powerful than himself. What he feels, as a result, is very different from the anomic sense, common to mass societies, of being only one of many, because in this case, the many add up to something greater than the sum of the parts. What he feels is the confidence drawn from collective strength, which can amount, even in the face of death, to a kind of joy. If group living arose among hominids as a response to predation, it seems at least likely that the human capacity for intense feelings of group identification arose in the same kind of situation. Long before hominids had developed a technology of offense and defense, sharpened sticks or spears, axes, and slings, they would have discovered the value of a collective defense, standing together, making noise, brandishing sticks, throwing stones. As I suggested in Chapter 5, there may have been, over many thousands of years, natural selection for those humans or hominids who were particularly enthusiastic about the rituals of collective defense, who derived a pleasurable thrill from it, that is, as opposed to those, for example, who abandoned their fellows and ran for the nearest tree. Tree climbers still abound among us, but there is something in the experience of confronting danger as a group, an army, for example, or a mob, that can arouse a kind of exhilaration in almost anyone. Nationalism, however, is experienced not only by soldiers in armies. It is experienced, and often more strongly, by civilians who are far from any real danger and who have never drilled or fought. Nazi philosopher Alfred Rosenberg understood the connection between civilian nationalism and the intense community forged in armies, writing in 1937, "The German nation is just now about to find its style of life for good. It is the style of the marching column, regardless of where and for what purpose this marching column is to be used. It is a mark of the German style of life that no German wants nowadays to feel himself a private person." In the age of nationalism, patriotic ceremonies began to be designed, consciously or not, to give civilians the feeling that they, too, constituted a kind of army, united by common danger and bonded by rhythmic activities analogous to the drill. George L. Moss observes that the 19th century saw the introduction of rhythm into all ceremonies, marches, parades, and festivals, in order to transform the undisciplined masses into a disciplined crowd. The Marseillaise was the first national anthem set to a marching beat. In imitation, other nations began to sing their anthems to similarly infectious and militant rhythms. By joining in the national liturgy and singing national anthems, Moss writes, large numbers of people now had the experience of sublimating themselves to the greater national community. Other developments, too, were encouraging the civilian to participate in the thrill of collective defense, from his or her armchair in most cases. The various factors which Anderson identifies as preconditions for nationalism, a common language, a sense of common traditions and history, and organized media to engage the citizens' attention. The civilian who reads, on a wall poster or in a newspaper, that the Austrians are marching on Paris or the French are marching on Moscow, that all that is French or Russian now lies in peril, has been drawn in to the alarms and thrills of collective defense. The function of the media in this case is emotional entrainment. Just as the drill causes men to move in the same way at the same time, the media are capable of arousing the same or similar feelings in large numbers of civilians at the same time. And as large numbers of people become aware of feeling the same thing at the same time, perhaps only because the media are quick to tell them what everyone else is supposedly feeling, they come to share in the soldiers' exalted sense of being part of something larger than themselves. This awareness of something larger, into which the individual might merge, is repeatedly expressed in 19th-century philosophical writings, where economically-oriented thinkers like Marx saw only the isolation and anomy induced by the capitalist economy. Others, like Hegel before him and the philosopher J.G. Fichte, saw the emergence of a new collective identity, through which, as Fichte put it, each single person becomes part of an organized whole and melts into one with it. No doubt the two perspectives are, as Marx might say, dialectically connected. As the average citizen experienced an ever greater economic reality of individual isolation, he or she became more open to, and perhaps even eager for, the feeling of submergence within some larger community, no matter how vague and imaginary that community might be. It is time now to look more closely at this larger whole that the individual melts into. For the soldier, it is, in the most literal sense, the army. The first modern armies, starting in the 17th century, went to great lengths to strip from each soldier all sense of individual uniqueness and to impress on him that he had no will or ambition other than that which the army allotted to him. Beginning in the late 18th century, though, in the era of revolution, the larger whole takes on a far less literal meaning, as the nation, which potentially embraces civilians, too. What is this new entity that men and women, insofar as they also achieve the status of citizens, profess themselves willing to die for? The first clue is that the nation is not a static community, but one that is imagined as existing in time. As Anderson puts it, rather ornately, the nation is a sociological organism, moving calendrically through homogeneous, empty time. It has a past. It is nothing, in fact, without a past. Even brand new nations attempt to situate themselves within some long-standing tradition. The human struggle for freedom and self-determination, for example, or recurring necessity, when in the course of human events. Much of the work of imagining the nation as a community lies in the effort to resurrect or invent a national past. And this past is, in most cases, defined by war. Serbs look back to the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. Americans look to Lexington and Bunker Hill. As Michael Howard has written, France was Marengo, Austerlitz, and Jena. Military triumph set the seal on the newfound national consciousness. Britain was Trafalgar. But it had been a nation for 400 years, since those earlier battles, Crecy and Agincourt. Russia was the triumph of 1812. Italy was Garibaldi and the Thousand. Could a nation, in any true sense of the word, really be born without a war? The nation, then, is our imagined link to the glorious deeds, or the terrible atrocities still awaiting revenge, that were performed by others long ago. To put it another way, the nation is a warrior lineage in which everyone can now claim membership. With the democratization of glory, every citizen is encouraged to think of himself or herself as a member of a noble bloodline. The French replaced the Bourbons. And as every noble lineage had its special heraldry, every nation has its flag. The exaltation that a patriotic citizen feels at the sight of his or her flag is in part pride in the imagined lineage to which every citizen now belongs. Those who came before us, and those who gave their lives so that. A similar upgrading of the common person occurred in Japan in the 19th century, after the Japanese had re-embraced the gun and created a modern mass army. According to Edwin O. Reischauer, modern mass education had quickly spread the strong nationalism of the upper classes of the late Tokugawa period to all Japanese. But more remarkably, it had soon convinced the descendants of peasants, who for almost three centuries had been denied swords and other arms and had been exploited by a military caste above them, that they too were members of a warrior race. But a lineage is still a lifeless abstraction compared to what we think of as a nation. A lineage cannot act except through its individual representatives, whereas nations act all the time. They enter into alliances, issue statements, make treaties, and, most decisively, make war. Even more anthropomorphically, one commonly reads of nations mourning, remembering, risking, and daring. To thinkers like Hegel, and the even more overtly nationalist writers who followed him, the nation was a living being. The organism Anderson refers to, only not merely sociological, but with an occult sort of life of its own. As Hegel put it, substituting state for nation. Predicates, principles, and the like get us nowhere in assessing the state, which must be apprehended as an organism. Just as predicates are of no help in comprehending the nature of God, whose life instead must be intuited, as it is in itself. Even the least philosophical patriot understands the nation as something that lives, at least in the sense that it will live on after him. Hence the readiness, even eagerness, of the patriot to die for his country. If the nation is an immortal being, and he is part of it, then, in dying to defend it, he is in fact participating in that immortality. Just as in ancient religions, blood sacrifice had a fructifying, generative function, helping to make the crops grow and herds increase, so too the sacrifice of oneself for the nation can be construed as a life-giving act. The Gallipoli campaign has been described as the most glorious failure in military history, the Sydney Morning Herald observed in 1922. But was it a failure to Australia? It has made us a nation. Was the price worth paying? Are not nations like individuals? If the nation is to be born, if the nation is to live, someone must die for it. In the opinion of Hegel and the later theorists of nationalism, nations need war, that is, the sacrifice of their citizens, even when they are not being menaced by other nations. The reason is simple. The nation, as a kind of organism, exists only through the emotional unity of its citizens, and nothing cements this unity more decisively than war. As Hegel explained, peace saps the strength of nations by allowing the citizens to drift back into their individual concerns. In times of peace, civil life expands more and more. All the different spheres settle down. And in the long run, men sink into corruption. Their particularities become more and more fixed and ossified. But health depends upon the unity of the body. And if the parts harden, death occurs. Meaning, of course, the death of the nation, which depends for its life on the willingness of its citizens to face their own deaths. War thus becomes a kind of tonic for nations, reviving that passion for collective defense that alone brings the nation to life in the minds of its citizens. Heinrich von Treitschke, the late 19th century German nationalist, put it excitedly, "One must say, in the most decided manner, war is the only remedy for ailing nations. The moment the state calls, 'Myself and my existence are at stake,' social self-seeking must fall back, and every party hate be silent. The individual must forget his own ego and feel himself a member of the whole. In that very point lies the loftiness of war, that the small man disappears entirely before the great thought of the state." Considered as a living being or organism, the nation is clearly both awesome, like a deity, and at the same time far less admirable, in the sense of being constrained by any kind of morality, than the individuals it comprises. Ordinary citizens must refrain from violence, from theft and other crimes. But the nation, acting in an arena of other nations, is governed by no higher law, or, judging from the impotence of institutions like the United Nations and the World Court in our time, by none worth mentioning. Citizens who have a dispute to settle must seek the judgment of the courts. Nations are more likely to duke it out on the field of battle. Citizens who brawl on the streets are punished. Nations that go to war are feared and often respected. If the nation as organism has a personality, it is that of the mounted warrior of old, impetuous, belligerent, touchy about all matters of honor, and in a state of readiness, at all times, for war. At a more archaic level of the imagination, the nation as organism becomes something more or less than human. Here is a creature that, according to Hegel, requires blood in order to sustain its life. The blood of actual human beings. We recognize, in this view of the nation, another version of humanity's primordial enemy and original deity, the predator beast. And in fact, it is only in the era of nation states that Europeans routinely came to see the enemy as a monster or beast. In the pre-modern European warfare of warrior elites, the ties of class and kinship that linked elite combatants on both sides made it difficult to think of the enemy as anything other than human. By the 20th century, though, newspaper cartoons and propaganda posters routinely represent the other side as a serpent, a vampire, a rat, or even a shark. But it is not only the enemy nation which comes to resemble a non-human threat to human life. Predatory creatures play a major role in the flags, coats of arms, and less formal symbols that various nations adopt for themselves. The eagle for the United States, Germany, Mexico, Poland, and Spain. The lion for Britain, Czechoslovakia, Finland, Kenya, the Netherlands, Norway, and Iran. The hawk for Egypt. The bear for Russia. What we become when we merge into that something larger than ourselves that the nation represents is what our species has most deeply feared and passionately longed to be. 13. Three cases of war worship. The idealization of war by peoples become primitive again is no sign of moral decadence, but on the contrary, the sign of a new hero worship and sacrificial spirit. Count Kaiserling. Lofty feelings directed toward an intangible, superhuman being. Most people of our own time would recognize these as the ingredients of a religion. The analogy between nationalism, and I mean, of course, secular nationalism, and religion has been drawn many times. Benedict Anderson admits nationalism's strong affinity with religious imaginings. Toynbee went further, seeing nationalism as a replacement for Christianity, which had been vitiated by a soulless capitalist economy. But for the most part, the relationship between nationalism and religion has been left as a sort of decorative analogy. Few, if any, have pressed the issue or found it useful to pursue the notion of nationalism as a religion, complete with its own deities, mythology, and rites. One reason we hesitate to classify nationalism as a kind of religion is that nationalism is a thoroughly modern phenomenon. It emerges in Europe in the 19th century and is spread throughout the Third World, largely in reaction to European imperialism, in the 20th century. Our own modernist bias convinces us that things which are recent must also be modern, in the sense of being rational and progressive. On one side of that great historical divide identified as the Enlightenment lie superstition, oppression, and fanatically intolerant religions. It is on the other side, along with science and a faith in progress, where we locate nationalism. To acknowledge that nationalism is itself a kind of religion would be to concede that all that is modern is not necessarily progressive or rational, that history can sometimes take us backward toward what we have come to see as the archaic and primitive. It is in times of war and the threat of war that nationalism takes on its most overtly religious hues. During the temporary enthusiasms of war, such as those inspired by the outbreak of World War I, individuals see themselves as participants in, or candidates for, a divine form of sacrifice. At the same time, whatever distinctions may have existed between church and state, or more precisely, between church-based religions and the religion of nationalism, tend to dissolve. During World War I, for example, secular authorities in the United States devised propaganda posters in which Jesus was dressed in khaki and portrayed sighting down a gun barrel. For their part, religious authorities can usually be counted on to help sacralize the war effort with their endorsements. During the feverish enthusiasm of World War I, the Bishop of London called on Englishmen to kill Germans, to kill the good as well as the bad, to kill the young men as well as the old. As I have said 1,000 times, I look upon it as a war for purity. I look upon everyone who dies in it as a martyr. But if nationalism is to be more than a temporary passion whipped up by war, it has to find ways to sustain and institutionalize itself, apart from more conventional religions. It must, in other words, assume some of the trappings of a conventional church-based religion itself. Uplifting myths are required, special holidays, and rituals that can be enacted by people who may not feel, at the moment of enacting, any great passion at all. Such rituals and myths keep nationalism alive during times of deprivation and defeat, even during interludes of peace, just as, say, Christian ritual preserves the faith in people who may only occasionally, or once in a lifetime, experience genuine spiritual transport. It was World War II that saw the full flowering of institutionalized religious nationalisms, designed to maintain the fervor of whole populations for months and years at a time. In many ways, the Second World War was a continuation of the First, growing out of grievances implanted by the First War and featuring some of the same alliances and forms of war making. The tank, the submarine, and the airplane, for example, which did so much to distinguish World War II from the wars of previous centuries, were all first deployed in World War I. So the two wars may be seen as a continuum analogous to the 30 Years' War, a double war that could not find a way to stop. But World War II was distinct in ways that required the sustained emotional mobilization of the participant populations. First, there was the sheer size of the armies involved. The armed forces of the United States, which had numbered about 5 million in World War I, reached over 16 million at the height of World War II. And other belligerents put similar proportions of their populations into uniform. More important, though, was the fact that this was a total war. In World War I, there had still been some inhibitions against the targeting of civilians, who ended up accounting for 15% of the fatalities. By World War II, the destruction and exploitation of civilians was deliberate policy on all sides. The British used air power to de-house the German population. The U.S. bombed the civilian populations of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden. The Germans and Japanese destroyed cities and exploited defeated populations as slave labor. As a result, in World War II, the civilian share of fatalities, including Holocaust victims, shot up to 65% of the total. Air power made the mass bombings of civilians possible, but it was the huge involvement of civilians in the industrial side of war that made it seem strategically necessary. In the culmination of a trend underway since the beginning of gun-based warfare, millions of civilians were now enlisted in the business of manufacturing weapons and otherwise supplying the increasingly massive armies. In this situation, there were no innocent civilians, except possibly children. And the war took on a genocidal character, unknown to the more gentlemanly conflict of 1914 to 1918. Nowhere was this clearer than in the U.S. confrontation with the racially different Japanese. William Halsey, the commander of the United States Naval Forces in the South Pacific, favored such slogans as "Kill Japs, kill Japs, kill more Japs," and vowed, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, that by the end of the war, Japanese would be spoken only in hell. In its relentless appetite for manpower, World War II even challenged the traditional male exclusivity of war. Women not only filled in for missing males in munitions factories and other vital industries, they were invited into the U.S. and British armed forces as clerical and administrative workers, issued uniforms, and allowed to participate in the pageantry, as well as the risks of war. Soviet women, or at least some of them, briefly achieved full warrior status, flying combat missions, acting as snipers, and participating in human wave assaults. In a war in which a civilian faced nearly the same chance of dying as a soldier, there was no protected status for females anyway. War was everywhere, and everyone was a part of it. The distinctively religious nationalisms that emerged around the time of World War II drew heavily on familiar religious traditions, but inevitably rendered them more primitive and parochial. Recall Karl Jaspers's classification of religions as pre- and post-axial, with the axis being that ancient equivalent of the Enlightenment, the heyday of classical Greece. The pre-axial religions were tribalistic, postulating deities, with limited jurisdictions and loyalties, while the post-axial religions were, at least in theory, universalistic and addressed to all people alike. Thus, all the participants in the bloodbath of World War II were adherents of, or at least familiar with, creeds that held out some notion of the brotherhood of man. Christianity, in the case of the Americans and Europeans, Buddhism, in the case of the Japanese, and, if it can be counted as a kind of religion, the atheistic ideology of international socialism, in the case of the Soviets. But nationalism is nothing if not tribalistic, and cannot, by its very nature, make the slightest claim to universalism. No one expects Poles to offer their lives for Peru, or goes proselytizing among Canadians to win their allegiance to the flag of Nigeria. In the religion of nationalism, the foreigner is always a kind of heathen, and, except in unusual circumstances, unsusceptible to conversion. To the extent that nationalism replaced the universalistic, post-axial religions, as Toynbee saw it doing, human beings were abandoning the bold dream of a universal humanity and reverting to their tribalistic roots. Nowhere was this clearer than in the Soviet Union, where the war prompted Stalin to abandon the universalistic ideology of communism for a narrow and quasi-religious nationalism. Nationalism, he observed, was the key to maintaining civilian morale, and he exhorted his people to follow the example of our great ancestors, a category in which he now listed not only Lenin, but such counter-revolutionary figures as Tsarist generals, feudal landlords, and even a saint of the Russian Orthodox Church. At the same time, the Soviet government displayed a sudden friendliness toward the traditional Russian Orthodox religion, halting anti-religious propaganda, and permitting the Church to re-establish a Holy Synod. In 1944, the glaringly anachronistic Internationale was replaced with a new, more suitably, parochial anthem. Here we will look briefly at three examples of the kinds of religious nationalism that were associated with, or grew out of, World War II. Nazism in Germany, State Shinto in Japan, and the ritualized patriotism that emerged in the post-war United States. Each of these served its adherents as a religion by offering an entire worldview, justifying individual sacrifice and loss, and mobilizing the uplifting passions of group solidarity. And as religions, each has reached back, past Christianity, or in the Japanese case, Buddhism, to more ancient, pre-axial kinds of religion. Pre-Christian European religion in the case of Nazism, Shinto itself in Japan, and Old Testament Judaism in the case of American nationalism. Nazism. Nazism may be the closest thing there has been to a freestanding religion of nationalism, unbeholden and even hostile to church-based religions. Historian Arno Meyer observes that Nazism had all the earmarks of a religion. Its faith and canon were institutionalized in and through a political movement, which bore some resemblance to a hierarchical church. The self-appointed head of this church, the Führer, exercised strict control over a ranked political clergy, as well as over a select order of disciples, with all the initiates wearing uniforms with distinct emblems and insignias. During both the rise of Nazism and the life of the Nazi regime, this clergy acted as both the celebrants and the congregations for a wide range of cultic ceremonies, some of which took place in sacred shrines and places. Most of these ceremonies were conspicuously public and massive, their purpose being to exalt, bind, and expand the community of faithful. Hitler would have agreed with Meyer. "We are not a movement," he told his followers. "Rather, we are a religion." The purpose of his ministry of propaganda and enlightenment was to communicate, not information, he remarked, but holy conviction and unconditional faith. Nazism had its own prophet, the Führer, its own rituals of mass rallies and parades, even its own holy days. According to historian Robert G. L. Waite, the Nazi holidays included the 30th of January, the day Hitler came to power in the year he referred to as the Holy Year of Our Lord, 1933, and the 20th of April, his own birthday, and the day when the Hitler Youth were confirmed in their faith. The holiest day was the 9th of November, celebrated as the Blood Witness, Blutzeuge, of the movement. Ordinary citizens found many ways to participate in the new religion. They displayed Mein Kampf in their homes, in the place of honor once reserved for the Bible. They even addressed prayers to the Führer. The League of German Girls, for example, developed its own version of the Lord's Prayer. Adolf Hitler, you are our great leader. Thy name makes the enemy tremble. Thy Third Reich comes. Thy will alone is law upon earth. And so on. Ceremonies of Nazi oath-taking consciously paralleled religious rites of confirmation, as this account from a Nazi newspaper makes clear. Yesterday witnessed the profession of the religion of the blood in all its imposing reality. Whoever has sworn his oath of allegiance to Hitler has pledged himself unto death to this sublime idea. Raised as a Catholic himself, Hitler drew heavily on Christian imagery for his religious fantasies. He often compared himself to Jesus, or in a more Jewish formulation, to the promised Messiah. He thought of the SS as his own version of the Society of Jesus. But he and his followers had no use for Christianity's claims to universalism, nor, of course, for its appeal to mercy, and took measures to restrict the role of the German churches. A more congenial religious foundation for Nazism could be found in the pre-Christian Germanic beliefs that nationalist intellectuals had dug up and imaginatively reconstructed during the 19th and early 20th centuries. According to Guido von List, a leading popularizer of such Volkish ideology, Christianity, with its gospel of love, had been a disaster for the ancient German people, leading to the debilitation of Teutonic vigor and morale. Nazism represented a return to the unsullied warrior culture associated with the ancient tribal Germans. Its swastika was lifted from the mythological Aryan repertory of images, and its state was meant to recall the pagan male warrior band, or Männerbund. Hitler himself was a fanatical devotee of war and nationalism as the religion of war. As Keegan argues, much of his outlook and ambition was shaped in the trenches of the Western Front, where he served as an infantryman from 1914 through 1917, in a regiment which, like so many others, lost more than 100% of its initial troop strength. Again and again, young Hitler survived artillery bombardments that left his comrades piled up dead around him, only to see their replacements similarly dispatched. No doubt he owed some of his messianic sense of himself to these narrow escapes. And it may be also that the relentless industrialized slaughter of trench warfare served as psychological preparation for the annihilation of the Jews and other undesirables at home. There is no question, though, that the war was, for Hitler, an experience of religious intensity. He wrote in Mein Kampf of being overcome with rapturous enthusiasm at the outbreak of the war. On the train ride to the front, when the troops spontaneously burst into Die Wacht am Rhein, Hitler recalled, "I felt as though I would burst." He was a brave and dedicated soldier, though prone to annoy his comrades by lecturing them on politics or the evils of smoking and drinking. Thoroughly puritanical in his devotion to war, he later described the trenches as a monastery with walls of flame. Thus, the Nazis did not rely on the traditional Christian rationale, vengeance for the killing of Christ, for their genocidal treatment of the Jews. In the Nazi theology, A major crime of the Jews was to have betrayed their country in war. Never mind that German Jews had served loyally in the First World War. Never mind that they were, by the 30s, more thoroughly assimilated into Gentile society than they had ever been. To Hitler, they were a hateful, even mocking reminder of defeat. In the Nazi imagination, Jews were prominent among those responsible for the famous stab in the back that supposedly prevented German victory in the First World War. For the Germans to regain their archaic purity as warriors, all traces of this foreign evil had to be expunged. Only then could the nation rise up as a single organism from the humiliation of defeat to the status of global predator. There is a tantalizing detail in Waitz's study of Hitler: his fascination and identification with wolves. As a boy, he had been pleased to find that his given name was derived from the old German Adelwolf, meaning noble wolf. He named his favorite dog Wolf, called the SS his pack of wolves, and believed that crowds responded so rapturously to him because they realized that now a wolf has been born. Mimi Reiter, a teenaged Austrian girl who was briefly involved with Hitler in 1926, recalled a curious outburst in a cemetery where they had gone, at Hitler's request, to visit Mimi's mother's grave. As he stared down at her mother's grave, he muttered, "I am not like that yet. Ich bin noch nicht so weit." He then gripped his riding whip tightly in his hands and said, "I would like you to call me Wolf." This incident, assuming it was correctly remembered, bespeaks a worldview divided into the most archaic categories of all. Not Aryan versus non-Aryan, or Gentile versus Jew, but predator versus prey. Hitler had seen too much like that, too many comrades reduced to meat. To be dead is to be vanquished, is to be prey. But in Hitler's worldview, there is no middle ground, no mode of existence apart from this bloody dichotomy. Those who do not wish to be prey must become predators. Conversely, those who are not predators are prey. To have survived the First World War in Hitler's case is to have achieved the status of the wolf. The ancient European warrior sought to transform himself into a wild carnivore. So too, Hitler transcended the failed art student he had been as a youth, survived the war, and become what was, in his own mind, the only thing he could be: a predator beast. State Shinto. By the time of the Second World War, Japan already boasted a 50-year tradition of secular nationalism, promulgated relentlessly through every institution of Japanese life. Public education, which reached 90% of Japanese children by 1900, included military training for boys, and the systematic inculcation of militarism and emperor worship for both sexes. Arithmetic classes did calculations based on battlefield situations. Science class topics included general information about searchlights, wireless communication, landmines, and torpedoes. A reading text offered the story of an insufficiently enthusiastic sailor, whose mother admonishes him, "You wrote that you did not participate in the Battle of Toshima Island. You were in the August 10th attack on Wei Hai Wei, but you didn't distinguish yourself with an individual exploit. To me, this is deplorable. Why have you gone to war? Your life is to be offered up to requite your obligations to our benevolent emperor." Among the institutions enlisted to the aims of Japanese imperialism was Shinto, the traditional religion. One of the world's oldest surviving religions, Shinto features thousands of deities, or kami, which are worshipped in private homes and at thousands of shrines around the country. Until the Meiji period, in the late 19th century, Shinto seems to have been largely apolitical, and not even, by the overheated standards of the West, very religious. It coexisted peaceably with Buddhism concerning itself with the maintenance of the shrines, the observance of festivals, and the performance of domestic rituals and weddings. It is no wonder that so many of the samurai had preferred Buddhism, with its austere metaphysic and magnificent indifference to death. But the samurai were a tiny elite, and their Zen Buddhism never attracted a numerically significant following. With the militarization of Japanese society that began near the turn of the 20th century, it was the ancient folk religion, Shinto, that was conscripted to the nationalist cause. Japan's victories in the First Sino-Japanese War, 1894 to 1895, and the Russo-Japanese War, 1904 to 1905, followed by the annexation of Korea, transformed the once reclusive island nation into one of Asia's leading military powers. Shinto priests were now expected to inculcate patriotism, along with more ancient forms of piety, and to preside over nationalistic rituals, such as the veneration of the emperor's portrait. In return, the Shinto priesthood was given public money for the training of priests and the maintenance of shrines, as well as state support in its growing rivalry with Buddhism. By the eve of World War II, Shinto had become, for all practical purposes, the state religion. The aim of state Shinto was what historian Helen Hardacre calls a nationwide orchestration of ritual, the entrainment of the entire population through simultaneous ritual observances. Children began the school year with patriotic celebrations, in which the emperor's official statement on education served as a sacred object of worship. Passengers on streetcars were required to stand and bow reverently when passing the imperial palace or important Shinto shrines. Older Shinto rituals were also recruited to the nationalist cause. Many of these, according to Ruth Benedict, were benign enough and certainly ancient. On the frequent days of rites, official representatives of the community came and stood before the priest while he purified them with hemp and paper streamers. He opened the door to the inner shrine and called down the gods, often with a high-pitched cry, to come to partake of a ceremonial meal. The priest prayed, and each participant in order of rank presented a twig of their sacred tree with pendant strips of white paper. What was new about state Shinto was the synchronization and centralization of ritual, so that the same ceremonies were now observed by everyone at the same time, from the emperor at a central shrine to peasants at their yoheisho, or place to worship from afar. No one, Christian or Buddhist, was exempted from what Hardacre calls this daring attempt at social engineering. To escape charges of religious totalitarianism, state authorities took the position that Shinto was not a religion at all, but something both more secular and more deeply rooted in Japanese life, the national spirit itself. At the metaphysical core of the new non-religion and overlapping more traditional Shinto concerns was the notion of kokutai, meaning literally, nation body. Kokutai parallels the European intellectual's notion of the nation as organism. It was the mystical living entity which arose from the fusion of individual citizens into a single and devoted mass. Symbolized by the emperor and the Shinto shrines, kokutai demanded absolute fealty from the citizenry, including a willingness to give their lives. As with European nationalist ideology, dying was no tragedy if one's death strengthened the nation body, or nation as organism. A document published by the Japanese Ministry of Education in 1937 makes an argument that could have been lifted from Hegel. Offering our lives for the sake of the emperor does not mean so-called self-sacrifice, but the casting aside of our little selves to live under the august grace and the enhancing of the genuine life of the people of a state. For all its continuities with the past, state Shinto by no means reflected some pre-existing Asian willingness to submerge the individual in the collective whole. Kokutai may have been an ancient word, but the Kokutai cult arose only in the 1930s. The whole notion of the nation as a mystical body, or organism, centered in the actual body of an individual leader, was a phenomenon of the modern era, the era of mass armies. In the era of a mounted warrior elite, Japan had nurtured an elite ethic of war, the samurai code, or bushido, analogous to the European knight's Christianized chivalry. But in the era of gun-based mass armies, bushido had to be democratized to include the masses, who were now free, as once only their superiors had been, to experience a glorious death in war. Just as European nationalism represented a democratization of an older elite warrior ethos, state Shinto was bushido for the masses. Like European nationalisms, state Shinto saw war as a sacred undertaking. The popular writer Tokutomi Ichiro described the Second World War in the ritual language of Shinto purification ceremonies.